Tales of the Left Hand, Book 3, written and read by John Maher. The story so far. Tesca and Yvette have begun settling into their new lives as members of the Blessed. Chapter 27. Tesca sat at the open door to the hayloft, just above the barn's main door. Some distance away, the sparse campfires of the pilgrims flickered amidst the ordered rows of tents. A quiet drone of chanting floated past him, some small portion of the pilgrims remaining awake, calling for salvation. A footfall behind him made him turn. Yvette.
"Can't sleep?" she asked in a low voice, settling down on the other side of the doorframe.
"We did sleep through most of the day," he gestured out into the darkness. "I remember hearing those prayers when we arrived. They're helping bring other memories to the surface."
Yvette nodded in approval, looking toward the campsite herself.
"It's so dark," she said. "Just a few campfires. It's like we're on the edge of the world."
Tesca chuckled.
"The edge of the world is further away than that. The Abbey's gatehouse is just beyond the fires, one shade lighter than the night. And at the top of the wall, there's a slight glow from lights inside the Abbey." He watched her squint into the darkness. "You can't see that?"
"No," she admitted after a moment. "I know it's there, of course, but I don't see anything."
Tesca nodded.
"That confirms it."
"Confirms what?"
"Whatever happened to me was more than healing some old and new injuries," Tesca told her. "About a year ago, I noticed I was starting to squint to see things far away. I didn't need glasses or anything like that, but it was a sign of things to come, you know?"
Yvette nodded.
"Looking out there tonight, I realized I wasn't squinting. My eyesight's sharper than it was, especially at night. And I think my hearing's improved as well."
"Yes, there was something you said this morning about overhearing Kalisandra as we entered the farmhouse," Yvette said. "I didn't hear her say anything."
"That was the first time I noticed something was different," Tesca said. "But even now, I can hear everyone else in the barn. When they move in their sleep, they're breathing. I'm still pretty tired, but I'm not sure I could sleep through Claude's snoring."
Yvette put a hand over her mouth to stifle a nervous laugh.
"Maybe you're right. Maybe I have been reborn in some way."
Yvette studied Tesca for a moment, saying nothing. Then she looked back toward the campsite.
"Are you prepared to go out there tomorrow?"
"As much as I'll ever be. Sitting in here an extra day won't accomplish anything. Besides, it's probably not good for your father to be on his own out there."
"For whom?" she asked with a wry smile. "Him or the sod priests?"
Tesca grinned as he mimed flipping a coin and catching it between his palms. He lifted one hand, peering at the imaginary result, then shrugged. Yvette stifled another laugh, this one more relaxed. Then she turned serious.
"You've really no experience with the faith, have you?"
Tesca shook his head. "I grew up in the heart of the Empire. There were few there who'd even heard of the Triad. Since coming north, though, I've read the Book of the Triad a few times, to get a passing familiarity."
Yvette sighed.
"You talk about it as if it's something to be studied for an exam."
She pointed out to the campsite.
"They don't think of it that way. It's the book. Like as not, the only book most of them have ever read, if they can read at all. The rest have had it read to them all their lives. They can probably recite significant portions of it from memory. As one of the Blessed, I think you'll be expected to know the book backwards and forwards."
"A passing familiarity is the best they get," Tesca said with a shrug. "Having scripture memorized doesn't appear to be a requirement for being healed. If that was the case, then I'd be dead, and your father would have 10 fingers instead of 6.
Yvette made a wry smile at that.
"About all I can do tonight is try to figure out what I was talking about the day we arrived."
"Yes," Yvette agreed. "I think it's important that you do. If what Merritt and Bela said was any indication, that's all anyone will be asking you tomorrow."
Tesca nodded, thinking back to the early evening when Merritt and Bela returned to the barn just after sunset. Tesca had seen Bela's tearful farewell with her husband from the hayloft door, so he was expecting a resentful glare from her when she came in, but Merritt's fury had surprised him. The thin man had stomped indignantly up to Tesca.
"What is the blue light?" he demanded. "And the Hall of Demons?"
"And who's Rose?" Bela chimed in.
Teska stared at them, dumbfounded. But the words sounded familiar, releasing a trickle of memory that he desperately tried to collect. Closing his eyes, he could see the blue light, see a delighted young face laughing in its glow, but he couldn't hold on to it, couldn't anchor the memory to anything else.
"Answer me," Merritt snapped, poking Teska in the shoulder.
An instant later, he was kneeling on the ground, his arm bent painfully back in Teska's grip. Teska kept his tone conversational, almost friendly. "You'll want to keep your hands to yourself, friend, or we'll get to see how fast one of the blessed heals a broken wrist." Then, sensing the sudden silence around him, he looked up at the others. They were frozen, staring at the sudden action. Some were fearful. Gwinnen in particular was cringing, ready to bolt. But some of the others, Barza and Drienne in particular, looked mildly amused at Merritt's situation. It was Barza who spoke first.
"Found out while you were gone, Merritt, that Travis was a Gideon Ranger before he came here," the Terrandon merchant said dryly. "Might have done you well to learn that before puffing yourself up to play the rooster."
"Travis," Drienne said politely, "will you let him go, please?"
"Of course," Teska said, releasing his hold and calmly taking a step back. Merritt scrambled a few feet further away before rising, cradling his sore wrist. Teska turned to Bela, who stiffened.
"It's all right," he said in a soothing tone. "I just want to know what happened out there."
The woman's breaths were coming quick, her eyes wide, but she nodded.
"Said you were shouting things when you arrived, they did. Everyone heard you. You called to the father, and you said you'd been here before."
Teska looked to Yvette, who nodded.
"It is true, husband. The night before we arrived, you began raving. Little of what you said could be considered words, and none of those made sense. But then, when we got here, after you were being brought down from the wagon, suddenly you sat up and shouted those things in a clear voice."
She glanced around at the others.
"Then you spoke of the blue light and the Hall of Demons."
"What do those mean?" Merritt shouted. "They kept asking us about them. They wouldn't listen to anything else I had to say."
He looked angry again, a frustrated bewilderment.
"There's no Hall of Demons in the book, and there's no blue light either. If they're not in the book, then why did you say them?"
"And what's the rose?" Bela asked. "That was something else they were asking about. You were yelling about roses as well."
"It's me," Yvette said, giving the blessed a sheepish grin as all eyes turned to her, including Teska's. "Rose is, well, it's a pet name he has for me when we are alone."
"That I remember," Teska said, immediately supporting her claim. He took her in his arms, kissing the top of her head as she buried her face in his chest.
"The rest," he sighed. "Merritt, Bela, I'm sorry, but I don't know what the other things mean."
He could see they didn't believe him.
"It's true," he protested. "It was the fever. I don't know what I was saying."
"You have to," Merritt said, sounding almost desperate. "Those things aren't in the book. They're not the truth. But they," he waved toward the campsite, "they don't see that. They're going astray. Some have begun to call you the Sun Reborn."
Teska was unfamiliar with the term, and he might have assumed that was due to his mere passing familiarity with the Book of the Triad, if not for the reactions of the other blessed. Even Yvette turned her head away from him to look at Merritt.
"The Sun Reborn? Who is calling him that?" she demanded.
Merritt drew himself up to his full height.
"Your father," he spat. "He was the one who started it, dogging our steps every minute of the morning, drawing the crowd's attention away from us. I finally told him to clear off, quoting the book to make my point, but he twisted my words, quoting the book himself. One of the acolytes finally escorted him away, but for the rest of the day, we heard him preaching to the crowd elsewhere. They were cheering him."
"My father," Yvette sighed, sounding weary. "My father is a very zealous man who has read the book every day of his life. He loves my husband as a son. Is it not understandable that he might let his zeal get the better of him?"
Merritt glanced at Teska before giving Yvette a sour glare.
"Kalisandra won't like that," Bela said. "Your father's changing things."
Harlan tugged on Barza's sleeve, speaking low, but Teska caught the whispered name.
Conrad!
Barza shrugged and patted the youth's hand.
Conrad? Who's Conrad?
Teska asked, looking at Barza and Harlan as much to shift focus away from Sidois's antics as anything else. Harlan looked scared, glancing reflexively toward the barn door. The rest of the Blessed went silent.
He was the first of us, Drien said at last, the first to be healed.
The silence stretched on.
And where is he now? Yvette asked.
Gone, Barza said simply.
He stood in the face of Teska's questioning stare, then with a sigh, sat down on a bale of hay.
He was a good man, Conrad. Drien and I knew him before Kalisandra and her lads arrived, before any of us received the gift. It was, maybe a week or two after Kalisandra and her boys moved out to the farmhouse. They planned to stay until the rains had passed and she'd have an easier time getting safe passage back to Terrandor. Conrad was a clubfoot, and one morning he awoke to find his twisted foot as straight as the other.
He chuckled, looking at Drien.
You remember watching him dance around the camp, laughing and shouting praise to the triad?
The Malakan woman nodded, her smile wistful.
Maybe a week later, Drien woke up able to draw a full breath for the first time in months. About 3 days after that, it was my turn.
What was your condition? Teska asked.
I had a palsy all down my left side,
the Terrandin explained.
Sometimes I couldn't hold anything in that hand or bear any weight on that leg. But as those changes were happening to us, there were more changes going on in the whole camp. More folk wearing the white were coming up the road from Maipur, a lot more, and they were all from Eastern Terrandor. When a full sword commander, especially one as famous as the Mother of Steel, decides to travel to a place rumored to heal the sick, that's news. As she traveled from the Kefi borderlands to the sea, folk began to follow in her wake.
Teska nodded. So your population doubled?
Tripled, corrected Barza, with more on the way. Don't know if Kalisandra felt responsible for them coming here, or if she's just the sort of woman who needs to arrange things. Probably a bit of both, to be honest. In any case, she and her boys began escorting the pilgrims up to the abbey in groups, capturing and hanging the bandits who'd been preying on them. She also put the healthier folk to work digging latrines, getting the fields ready for spring planting, and foraging for more food from outlying regions. Not long after Harlan joined us, she moved us to the barn. To be sure, we didn't mind a wooden roof over our heads instead of canvas, but she also set a guard on the front door, saying that it was for our protection.
From the monks, Teska guessed. He couldn't think of any other group that Kalisandra might decide was an enemy. Barza nodded.
Always been a few monks who came out each day to speak to us, examining our various ailments and offering treatments. When Conrad suddenly got up and began dancing around on two good feet, more of them came out, wanting to talk to him. Kalisandra wouldn't hear of it. She kept the monks away, saying we couldn't trust folk who dared question a miracle. Later she informed us that the monks were planning to kidnap us in the middle of the night and carry us off, so she moved us into the barn. Conrad didn't believe her. Not one word.
This started some mutterings among the other Blessed, but Barza held up a hand for silence.
Before he was cured, he'd become friends with one monk in particular who'd taken an interest in his clubfoot. Every few days, she'd bring out an odd-looking shoe she'd made and ask him to wear it for a day or so, then tell her how it felt. They'd become friends, and Conrad was someone who could take the measure of people. He was certain that this woman would never be party to kidnapping anyone. He wouldn't hear a word against her. And to be honest, he wanted to go home, to share his good fortune with his family.
He looked at Harlan.
What was it he used to say, lad?
The best way I can honor the Triad's gift to me is to live a simple, quiet life, the young man replied.
Merritt made a quiet noise of disbelief at that, which Barza ignored as he resumed his story.
So Conrad tried to catch a ride on the wagon back down to Maipur, but Kalisandra wouldn't let him. She said he needed to stay here, to inspire others to keep their faith and receive healing in their turn. She said if he wanted to go back to the city, he'd have to walk by himself, and there were still bandits along the road at that time. And even if Conrad was willing to risk the bandits, by then her lads had collected all the food from the camp to ration it out and took away the bucket by the well near the farmhouse, so folk could only get water when she allowed them to.
She made it clear that neither food nor water would be wasted on someone who wanted to leave.
What happened? Teska asked.
Well, Conrad prayed for an entire day and night seeking guidance. Then, a few nights later, after hoarding what food and water he could from the rations, he left. There was a loose plank in the back of the barn. He slipped out that way, and that was the last we saw of him.
And the next morning, Yvette asked, when the sod priests realized he wasn't in the barn, what did they do?
Nothing, Barza said. They acted as if he'd never been there.
Maybe he made it down to Maipur, Harlan said. Maybe he made it back home.
Barza nodded.
Maybe. Though not a day after Conrad left, one of her boys came up and nailed that loose plank down tight.
Bela and Claude gave each other nervous looks. Teska realized that they had not heard this part of the story before. Gwynin seemed to curl further in upon herself, staring down at the floor. Merritt, however, gave a satisfied laugh.
The valiant and the craven each receive their due from the sun.
Harlan shot him an angry look.
Shut up! You weren't there! You didn't know him!
And why would I want to? Merritt sneered. He abandoned the faithful and the path he was set upon by the Triad. He selfishly chose to keep his gift to himself. I hope bandits did catch him.
Teska grabbed Harlan as the young man launched himself at Merritt. I think we've all said enough, he pronounced, meeting Merritt's eye. Merritt backed down in the face of Teska's unspoken promise. With a last sneer at Harlan, who still struggled to get out of Teska's grip, he turned away and climbed the stairs to the loft. That had brought the conversation to an end. The various blessed dispersed to different parts of the barn, some alone, others in pairs. Barza led the miserable Harlan away, talking quietly to him, while Yvette and Drienne went upstairs. Everyone seemed to studiously avoid Teska, and eventually he retreated to the open hayloft door at the front of the barn where he'd seen Merritt and Bela coming back from the campsite, and there he had remained, watching the sunset as night grew around them. He had wondered if the Blessed prayed in unison, as the sword priests encouraged everyone to do, and found that at least tonight, this was not the case. All of them prayed at least once that night, some more than once. Harlan prayed with Drienne, Yvette, and Barza, but he also came over to Claude and timidly asked to join him as well, to which the gangly Malakin silently agreed. Merritt prayed aloud, calling to the Triad for strength of purpose and unswerving dedication to spreading the faith. The silent young woman, Gwynin, knelt nearby, though if she was praying with Merritt or ignoring him as she prayed on her own, Teska couldn't tell. After a time, realizing that failing to pray himself would be noticed, he knelt on the floor and bowed his head. But no prayers came to mind. Though Terrandin by birth, he had always thought of the Triad as his father's faith. He was far more familiar with Sabrian beliefs, which centered around the worship of Hashema, Mother of Waters, and her volatile son Virado, Lord of Storms. Beneath those two primary divinities were an uncountable number of lesser gods. It had seemed to Teska that Sabrians invented gods at need, coming across a particular condition or natural occurrence and assigning a power to manage it. They ranged from Pasepha, who governed the household, specifically the resolution of family conflicts, to Ts, who kept gunpowder dry. The gods themselves changed as they rose and fell in popularity. One generation of Sabrians might worship two different deities of a similar nature that had each originated on a different island, but the next generation very likely would worship a single deity which incorporated the names and aspects of both. Or they might be absorbed into the worship of a third, more popular deity, and their specific origins would be lost in the melting pot of Sabrian faith. This had been a difficult concept for Rose and him to grasp when they had come to live among the Arnuai. The idea that the number or even the names of gods was not fixed ran contrary to their upbringing. The Arnuai children, on the other hand, were equally bewildered at the concept of the entire world being maintained by only three entities.
It is too much work, one of them had laughed when Aiden had tried to explain the Triad to him.
How could Ashema govern the tides if she had to busy herself with the baking of each loaf of bread, or keeping the granaries free of rats? These little matters she and her son leave to others.
Some years later, after he had begun his Agentis training, Tesca had asked his master if there was a god of Agenti.
Agenti have no god, Lorenus informed him. We respect the gods, yes, and the dedication of those who serve them. But the service of an Agentis is given solely to his master. He keeps no shrine, lights no candles, leaves no offerings upon altars.
Could an Agenti serve a priest?
It has happened, though it is rare for a priest to have need of such services. But know this, an Agentis may serve a servant of a faith, but he does not share in that faith. All that matters is that the prospective master possesses sufficient virtu to be worthy of service.
The young Tesca nodded. Could it be said, then, the god of the Agenti is virtu itself? For a long moment, Lorenus silently regarded Tesca, and Tesca had feared he'd spoken out of turn, violating yet another custom that all Sabrians took for granted. But then he saw the amused gleam in the old man's eye.
It is not said. Very often. It is something all Agenti must decide for themselves. But few of us ask that question so young.
His smile broadened.
There may be hope for you yet, Tesca.
Tesca had knelt for what he thought was a sufficient time, savoring that memory, before he rose and returned to the hayloft door, remaining there until Yvette had joined him.
When you shouted that you'd been here before, she asked, was that true?
Yes, Tesca replied. My father brought us here when I was a boy. I didn't remember that until I saw the Abbey gate that morning. I don't know why we came here, though, only that we did.
Who is we?
My sister and I. Her name was Rose. That was a good cover before, saying it was a pet name. She inclined her head in thanks.
All this helps explain what you said next. We all thought you were calling out to the father, but you were really talking to your own father, weren't you?
Tesca nodded.
So, if those other things were true, then perhaps somehow the blue light and the hall of demons are based in fact as well? You did say to Baza that you saw blue sky just before you were healed.
Her words struck a chord. You're right. But whatever I was shouting about must have happened when I was here before. Whatever I was seeing when I was healed, that happened yesterday.
Yvette looked amused. You're sure? You also called me Ali before I left the tent.
Oh. He gave her an awkward chuckle, then paused. Did you kiss me?
In farewell, she laughed, now a touch embarrassed. I was planning to slip out of camp that night. Donal was clearly intending to question us after your death.
A triad's not a triad with only two, Tesca said. You said that, didn't you?
Your memory's coming back quickly, she complimented him. I did try to leave, but that proved to be impossible.
She pointed down toward the ground where one of the sword priests was walking patiently back and forth, keeping watch on the path to the barn.
The owners of the last three swords in the farmhouse sleep during the day and patrol the camp at night, along with at least a dozen of the healthier pilgrims as a supplementary guard. Their patrols kept a tight ring around the rise where the tent was. Donal must have guessed my intention to flee that night. After an hour or two waiting for an opening I might slip through, I gave up and came back to the tent.
But you didn't come back inside. She shook her head.
No. I wasn't lying when I said the smell was too much for me. In the end, I said a prayer to the daughter to help me find a way out of this, and fell asleep.
She gave Tesca an odd smile.
I suppose she was listening.
Then her smile faded.
There is one other thing that you should know. I learned what message Donald brought back from Maipo. Kelisandra and her soldiers now know that your partner is here at the Abbey.
Kerala?
Kerala, she repeated. So that's how you say her name.
Why didn't you tell me before?
There was no point remembering to tell a dead man, she said. In any case, today's events put any news of Els right out of my head until now. It appears your friend did not conceal her true nature as well as she should have in my paw.
Perhaps, Teska said. There's at least one price on her head. It seems to me, though, that if someone recognized her, they'd have tried to collect the bounty for themselves. There's no profit in tipping off the sword priests and letting them handle it. Yvette considered that. Then she made an enemy who is content to let others do the work. But who? Who indeed, Teska replied. Then he stood up and padded across the loft, Yvette following him. There was enough light coming through the holes in the roof to find the stairs. Teska picked up the lantern set on the table and lit it with a match. Then he and Yvette descended to the ground floor. Which of these horses is the one that the messenger was riding? Teska asked. Yvette smiled, realizing Teska's intentions. Taking the lantern from him, she walked past each stall, shining the light onto each occupant. This one, she said in a low voice, waving him over and pointing to the horse's flank, where the light gleamed against the raised scar of a brand.
Very clever, Yvette complimented him.
You were the one who suggested that whoever sent the messenger might also have owned the horse.
Do you recognize the mark?
No, Teska replied, but I'll know it if I see it again. Then he turned toward the barn door. Someone's coming. Yvette frowned, listening.
I don't hear... Oh, your hearing has gotten better.
Now both of them heard footsteps outside the barn, and voices speaking low. Teska blew out the lantern and retreated with Yvette into an empty paddock. The barn door was opened and three men entered. Two carried quarterstaves, while the one in front carried a lantern.
Which one is it? Came an older voice, speaking Terrandon.
Second from the back.
All right, take that one and two of the less healthy ones, the older man ordered.
Teska and Yvette glanced at each other. Their paddock happened to be in the middle of the row. The men would walk right past them. But Teska remembered a story Kerla had told him from the Fete, a tactic used by her and Grievous when they were found by guards. He pulled off his shirt, then sat on the ground and drew Yvette into an embrace. She understood his intention quickly enough and climbed into his lap, picking up a fistful of hay and tossing it into the air above them so the strands settled onto their hair and clothes. A moment later, the man with the lantern passed their paddock, his light sweeping over them in a routine pass, but it stopped instantly when it reached them, huddled together. Yvette yelped and scrambled to her feet, Teska quickly following. The man gave a low, quick whistle, signaling the two men with him, who came to his side at once, their staves at the ready.
"Come out of there," the man ordered. "Now, who in the hells are—"
He broke off.
"Oh, my apologies, blessed ones. You're new arrived. We've not met until now."
He opened the lantern wider, spreading the light to reveal himself and the men with him. He was at least 15 years older than Teska, his dark hair and beard peppered with gray. His smile somehow managed to be both warm and guarded at the same time. Another full priest like Donal, Teska thought, recognizing the snap of command in the man's voice and the steady, piercing gaze. He was not surprised that Kelisandra had two lieutenants. She would want someone she trusted in command of the Night's Watch.
"Angus, I am," the priest went on.
He indicated the two younger men with him, who nodded respectfully to Teska.
"Braylon and Desmond."
Teska hastily donned his shirt, brushing the hay out of his hair before he stepped forward and offered the older man his hand, which Angus accepted after a moment's hesitation. His grip was firm and hard, a testing squeeze, which Teska returned, matching the man's strength.
"Travis Durham, my wife, Sophie. Sorry to surprise you. Sought more privacy than the cots above we did." "Of course," Angus replied. "Man and his wife have needs, they do. We'd not expected anyone to be awake, or we'd have knocked first. Well, is there aught we can do for you?" "Here to collect some horses for slaughter is all. Haven't the feed for all of them now. Best to eat a few and save the others from starving. Thought we'd collect them tonight and not disturb you."
Teska heard footsteps on the floor above them and turned to the stairs as Barza came down, stopping halfway.
"Angus?"
the half-awake man muttered.
"What's all this?"
The sword priest gave a rueful sigh.
"Sorry to wake you, Barza. We'd hoped to collect some horses while you slept. One for the wagon, the others for meat." "Oh, I see," Barza replied. "Getting the wagon ready for the next trip down to Maipur. Will you be taking the escort duty this time?"
Aye, the sword priest replied. Sure thing the faithful are gathering outside the city even now. We'll not keep them waiting long.
An amused smile crossed Barza's face as his gaze settled on Tesca and Yvette.
It appears others had some plans as well while we slept.
Tesca and Yvette both grinned sheepishly.
Well, little chance of getting on with that now, said Tesca. We'll get out of your way.
He led Yvette out of the paddock and headed for the stairs.
Heard you're from County Ferlin, Angus said, smiling broadly. A Ferlin myself I am. Mayhap we're kin. Bearing the name of Durham, you must be related to old Treston Durham.
Tesca grinned back, hiding his alarm.
Who isn't related to that old hound? He laughed. 12 children he had, and that's only those with his wife.
This drew a few chuckles from the younger sword priests and a raised eyebrow from Angus.
Ah, sorry, not a proper subject for one of the blessed to discuss, I'd imagine. Durham family tree looks like a ball of yarn after the cat's been at it, and truth to tell, Tesca went on, my dad didn't like to talk about exactly which branch we were on. I suspect my granddad was a byblow of Treston's who wormed his way back onto the rolls.
Angus chuckled, and Tesca could see that although he hadn't exactly passed the test, he hadn't failed it either. Tesca's answer was plausible, if evasive, and only someone who was familiar with the folk history of County Ferlin would know about Treston Durham's legendary, not to say lavish, fertility. But Angus had been as interested in the way Tesca answered the question as he had been in the answer itself. If Tesca had shown any hesitation or anxiety, that would become a line of inquiry for Angus to pursue further, seeking to catch Tesca in a lie. But Tesca had given him none of that, which neither confirmed nor allayed the man's suspicions. Tesca had slipped out of another trap, but he did not want to give Angus the opportunity to question him further. Tesca had been too young to clearly remember County Ferlin himself. What he did remember, with more clarity than he'd expected, were Dunstan Carrick's stories about their family's ancestral home, told around 1,000 campfires. But Tesca knew that his father hadn't always told the stories the same way. Dunstan had been happy to adjust the details here and there to keep an audience entertained. He knew those stories would not withstand a prolonged inquiry, and was glad Angus would be departing for Maipor soon.
Well, I'll not keep the three of you from your business, Tesca said to the older man.
Angus nodded.
A good night, then. May the triad continue to smile upon you.
He gestured to Desmond and Braylon, who nodded to them once more, then went into the paddocks to lead the horses out. Tesca and Yvette followed Barza up the stairs as the sword priests left. In the loft, all of the blessed were awake and looking at Barza with questioning expressions.
It's all right, Barza assured them. They were just coming in to collect a few horses. As I said, we should have a bit of meat over the next day or two.
And what were they doing down there? Merritt asked, pointing at Tesca and Yvette.
Tesca slipped his arm around Yvette's waist and gave Merritt a wink. The man made a disgusted sound while Bela gave them a jealous glare before whirling angrily back to her cot. Tesca and Yvette returned to their own sleeping area without further comment and stretched out on their cots, facing each other.
Did you notice which horses they collected? Yvette asked in a low voice.
Yes, Tesca replied. Angus was here specifically for the messenger's horse. I think Kelisandra wants to remove traces of any connection back to whoever warned her about Kerla.
He yawned as Yvette nodded in agreement, reflexively yawning herself a moment later.
Not a bad idea to get some more sleep.
Yes, tomorrow looks to be very busy. Good night.
She touched his arm, gripping his wrist firmly for a moment before turning away from him. Tesca closed his eyes, and it did not take him long to fall asleep. He dreamed that he was in a dark forest, hunting for small, exotic creatures with a lantern that emitted a soft, blue light. He knew that if he could shine that light on them, the little creatures would freeze in place and be easy to collect. But search as he might, he could not find a single one. This work is copywritten 2013 and has been written and recorded by John Maher. If you'd like to learn more about the Freeze, get yourself a bit of swag, or comment on this episode, please visit talesoftheleftand.com, where you can also find a link to our official Facebook page, and if you'd like, make a donation to help keep this series going. Thanks for listening.